Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the storm that has caused unprecedented flooding in Houston, now impacting New Orleans. Joining us is Mark Schlifstein, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the New Orleans Times-Picayune and author of Path of Destruction, The Devastation of New Orleans and the Coming Age of Superstorms. On the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina that struck 12 years ago, we will discuss whether the city has fully recovered, and although more flooding is expected in Houston and considerably less rain is predicted to hit New Orleans, there are questions whether the pumping system, some of which is 100 years old, will be able to cope with the rainfall. We'll also look into the politics of recovery since Texas Senator Ted Cruz opposed relief from Hurricane Sandy for New Orleans and New York, but now wants it for Texas, and how Louisiana's U.S. senators and most of its congressmen, who are global warming deniers, can continue to deal with the aftermath of superstorms without recognizing the causes. Then we'll get an update on the Russia inquiry following stories in the New York Times and the Washington Post that reveal efforts to contact Putin's inner circle by Trump's lawyer Michael Cohen and a Russian-born gangster and business partner of Trump's, Felix Sater, who was a childhood friend of Cohen's. James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist who was a Global Justice Fellow at Yale and a co-founder with David K. Johnson of DCReport.org and is the author of Blood Bankers, joins us to discuss a rider attached to an appropriations bill by Florida Republican Congressman Ron DeSantis blocking the Mueller investigation and whether or not the special counsel will come up with a smoking gun that could convince Trump's base that he should be impeached. Then finally, we will assess what response is likely to come from Japan after a North Korean missile crossed over its territory in a deliberate provocation, which Prime Minister Abe called, quote, an unprecedented, serious, and grave threat. Sheila Smith, a senior fellow for Japan Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Japan's New Politics and the U.S.-Japan Alliance, joins us to discuss how Japan and South Korea are likely to increase their defenses and forge closer military ties with the U.S., which might cause China to increase its pressure on Kim Jong-un. And joining us now from New Orleans is Mark Schlifstein, who is a reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. He has deep experience in covering the Gulf Coast science issues, and he and his colleague John McQuaid won a Pulitzer Prize in 1997 for a series on the world's oceans. Together, they wrote the book Path of Destruction, The Devastation of New Orleans and the Coming Age of Superstorms. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Schlifstein.
Thank you.
And obviously, the New Orleans is being hit now by rain from Hurricane Harvey, which has drenched Houston up to 40 inches. In some parts, it's going to go on for a couple more days and will reach probably about 50 inches. What kind of a deluge is New Orleans expecting?
Well, we've already gotten 7 or 8 inches of rain over the last couple of days, and we're expecting another 5 to 10 inches over the next day or so. So it could still be a problem. Our problem is going to be if one of these feeder bands around Harvey parks over top of the city and ends up with rain rates over an inch an hour. If it does that, we have real problems with the drainage system. Our drainage system has had some problems with some of its pumps not being in the best of shape, and part of its electric system also has been problematical for the last couple of months. So at the moment, the city says that we're about 93% of capacity, but individual pump stations have been down as much as 65% of capacity. So that could spell problems for some individual neighborhoods if we do get a lot of rain all at once.
And isn't it the anniversary of Hurricane Katrina?
It is indeed. 12 years ago, at this point in time, I was sitting in our newsroom wondering what the heck was what was happening at my home, which was about 10 miles away, which I knew was underwater. It was an interesting time, to say the least.
So, Mark Schlefstein, again, a reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. He has deep experience in covering Gulf Coast science issues. He and his colleague, John McQuaid, won a Pulitzer Prize for a series on the world's oceans. And together, they wrote the book, Path of Destruction, The Devastation of New Orleans and the Coming Age of Superstorms. Well, the age of superstorms seems to be upon us. We have, obviously, unprecedented rainfall as a result of the ocean surface being heated up and extra moisture in the atmosphere, along with subsidence, which has apparently 15 centimeters, the land has subsided, particularly around New Orleans, because of oil drilling. So if the land goes down and the sea's coming up, that's a recipe for disaster, isn't it?
It could very well be. The state has a 50-year, $50 billion plan to restore wetlands south of New Orleans and along the rest of the coast. And that is only about a half of what they know they really need, and probably is really only about a third of what they're going to need over the next century. The reality, though, is that they do have a pretty good start in mind, with money, ironically, from the BP oil spill from 2010. The fine money from that spill is being used to rebuild wetlands, and some of those projects already are underway, and a number of them will be built in the next 15 years as that money comes pouring in, close to $10 billion.
But presumably, if the worst happens in New Orleans in the next day or so, if the pumps fail, for example, you'll be competing with money for Houston, will you not?
Well, we will. But I really don't think that the flooding that might occur here, unless something amazing happens and this storm, you know, parks itself over top of us, which I don't see happening. Our flooding is not going to be anywhere near as bad as what Houston's undergoing right now. So it will be less of a problem. You know, one of the things that I've seen in the aftermath of Katrina is that Congress generally has a propensity of being a good neighbor when hurricanes occur. And we saw that after Katrina in 2005, 2006, and the years that followed. And we saw that after Hurricane Sandy in 2012. So, I never underestimate the ability of Congress to do the right thing.
Well, there's already a bit of contention going on over Senator Ted Cruz, the Texas senator who objected to relief for the victims of Hurricane Sandy in New Jersey, and now people are accusing him of hypocrisy. It does seem at the human level, I mean the citizen level, I should say, people are stepping up. The Louisiana Cajun Navy, a volunteer group that performs water rescues during floods, have all moved to the Houston area and are working around the clock. But that leads me to the question of your representation there. I think both of your U.S. senators are global warming deniers, aren't they?
Well, they have a problem with global warming, except when it comes to its effects in Louisiana. Their problem is with the causes and not with the effects. They see the effects occurring along our coasts and are rather supportive of a lot of the projects that are aimed at reducing the effects of sea level rise. And it's sort of ironic. We call it sort of the Louisiana schizophrenia. You know, it comes out of the reality, which is that we have a coastline that is highly dependent on oil and gas because of the amount of oil and gas that historically has been removed from underneath our surface and now is being taken out of the Gulf of Mexico off our shores that provide huge amounts of jobs for our neighbors. So they're supportive of that, while they're also supportive of the of the efforts of the state to restore wetlands and things like that. We do have a couple of congressmen who are a bit more amenable to understanding what climate change can and will do, including a Republican, Garrett Graves, who's actually from Baton Rouge, who used to be the head of the state's coastal restoration program, and has, you know, he's still a supporter of big oil, but at the same time, he is much more amenable to understanding the effects of climate change.
Well, just in closing, the long-term future of New Orleans surely can't depend upon 100-year-old pumps, right? Pumps themselves can't pump out more water than what is falling from the skies.
Well, our problem is twofold. We have the water that's falling out of the sky, and then we have the levee system that surrounds the city now that's been rebuilt after Katrina that is aimed at assuring our protection from storm surge caused by hurricanes. And it's that layer that rather than the pumps that is going to be our future in New Orleans proper. The concern that we have about that is what happens in 30 to 50 years when sea level rise reduces its ability to deal with a 100-year event, which is what is designed for. And of course, the other concern is that it is indeed designed, you know, to the National Flood Insurance Program standards of a 100-year event, something that can occur once, you know, has a 1% chance of occurring in any year. And that's probably not, you know, that's probably not enough for New Orleans, although the levee was overbuilt to the point where even if you had a 500-year event, we would have the ability of reducing the amount of flooding, but there would be flooding in the levee system.
Well, Mark Schlifstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, sure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Schlifstein, who is a reporter for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. He has deep experience in covering Gulf Coast science issues, and he and his colleague John McQuaid won a Pulitzer Prize for a series on the world's oceans. And together, they wrote the book Path of Destruction, The Devastation of New Orleans and the Coming Age of Superstorms. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an update on the Russia inquiry following stories in the New York Times and the Washington Post of Trump's lawyer and his business partner's efforts to contact Putin.
There's been a crash on the levee and mama, you've been refused. Well, it's king for king and it's queen for queen. This is gonna be the meanest flood that anybody's ever seen. Oh, mama, you're gonna miss your best friend now. You're gonna have to find yourself.
From Russia with love, I fly to you. Much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is James Henry, an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist. He is a Global Justice Fellow at Yale University and a Senior Fellow at the Center for Sustainable Investment at Columbia University and a lead researcher at the Tax Justice Network. He's the author of The Blood Bankers, and he's the co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreports.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Henry.
Good to be with you.
And Jim, what do you make of this U.S. Representative Ron DeSantis, a Republican of Florida? He's added a policy rider to the appropriations bill that would stop funding to special counsel Mueller's Russia investigations 180 days after becoming law and prevent the special counsel from probing matters that occurred prior to June 2015, the month that Donald Trump announced his presidential bid. This would indicate to me that if you got a Republican congressman, and who knows at whose behest he's operating, wanting to shut down the Mueller investigation and putting it on a must-pass spending bill, perhaps even involving funds for the cleanup of the Hurricane Harvey, that indicates to me that somebody's worried about this investigation, not the least of whom is Donald Trump.
Well, I don't know who's telling this congressman, giving him his marching orders. I think that that's a perfect example of self-destructiveness on the part of the Republicans. I mean, most Americans want this investigation completed, and I think even the White House probably wants the investigation completed. It's, you know, my classmate Ty Cobb is representing the president on this, and, you know, he's been pretty confident, at least in public, about feeling that the investigation is, you know, proceeding apace, and, you know, he's been cautious about trying to undermine it. So, yeah, I think it's unlikely that this, you know, one Republican congressman really speaks for the Republican Party, but, you know, they've been somewhat reluctant to part ways with Trump on other issues, so, you know, maybe. The big picture is that the Mueller investigation is now finally picked up pace, and there's a raft of subpoenas been issued. He has at least 16 attorneys, including some very experienced federal prosecutors. And so, you know, I think most people are interested in seeing what he's going to do with all this. He seems to be going after some of the senior advisors to Trump, like Manafort and Flynn, possibly trying to turn them, but we just don't know. You know, there's also a lot of speculation about this fellow Felix Sater, who, you know, everybody seems to have written about Felix Sater in the last year or so. I started writing about him last year. But, you know, today in the Times and the Washington Post, there were stories about Sater trying to stir up interest in another Trump tower in Moscow, the third effort that he's made in the last 10 years to put into, you know, since 2005, to get such a building. I mean, you'd think that if Sater had any influence with Putin, he would have had a Trump Tower in Moscow, but there is no such Trump Tower. And so there's, you know, some question about whether Sater isn't just the world's consummate flim-flam man.
Well, he's demonstrated ties to organized crime, and he's supposed to be connected to all kinds of gangsters and has a very spotty criminal record.
No, there's no question that he helped Trump raise money for the Trump Soho, a $400 million tower that's since gone belly up in Midtown Manhattan. If his criminal record hadn't been kept secret, partly by deals with, you know, Loretta Lynch and the EDNY here in New York, maybe he wouldn't have been able to raise all that money. You know, from Sater was very successful and helping to put together those deals, and Trump profited from them. But I think the worst you could say at this point that we know about Donald Trump from a criminal standpoint is that he profited from people like Sater and didn't really turn his back on him, probably at a time when he, you know, should have known, or maybe even did know, that Sater, for example, had at least two felony convictions as of 1999. So, you know, that's an issue that Mueller's got to grapple with, whether the president can be held, you know, under the RICO statutes, racketeering statutes, whether he can be held responsible for any of the criminal activity that Sater was involved with during this period. But point is that, you know, Democrats like Loretta Lynch were also kind of involved in helping this kind of financial Whitey Bulger keep on keeping on. And so it's not a simple story.
Well, let's talk about that then. I mean, the fact Sater may have been a flim-flam guy, but he also had ties to gangsters. He sounds like a very unsavory character. So on the surface, not the kind of person that presidents of the United States should be associating with. But he managed to get Ivanka to sit in Putin's chair inside the Kremlin. So he's got...
Well, that's what he says, and she said she was in some chair in the Kremlin. But, you know, where was Putin? I'd like to see the photos. It's a whole kind of a weird story. Mm-hmm. For all of these sitting in chairs, there was no deal done. You know, they claim that the VT Bank was about to put in $100 million into this Trump Tower in 2015.
never happened. I mean, Cohen, he's known since Michael Cohen, who's Trump's attorney. He's known Sater, you know, who moved to Brooklyn with his dad from Moscow in the 1970s and grew up in Brooklyn. And, you know, they've known each other for a long time. It's not surprising that they would be, you know, trading emails. The real question is, did Trump know that Sater was involved in this latest deal that came in 2015? Cohen says he never told him, you know, that he was just kind of flirting with Sater. And, you know, the Trump Organization didn't go out of business when Donald Trump was running for president. And it, as of, you know, November 2015, I doubt that Trump was betting on winning. So, you know, there was still some, you know, some appetite for doing deals around the world. And they'd long been seeking this deal in Moscow. I'm just trying to take, you know, play devil's advocate here because, like probably a majority of Americans, we would love to see a rerunning of the November election. But the point is that you know, there's a long history of kind of bad behavior by various people that Trump has been willing to do business with. But that doesn't all necessarily add up to any criminal behavior, let alone impeachable behavior on Trump's part. And I think to some extent the Democrats have gotten on this kind of, you know, sort of pipe dream, you know, rather than having to build up their own positive programs, alternatives to Trump, you know, and doing the hard work of organizing to convince, you know, Americans that their solutions are better. They have gone off on this wish list to have, you know, to Trump will simply disappear. He'll be impeached. You know, we'll find the smoking gun that finally gets him impeached. But, you know, so far we haven't had it.
So just to read from the email from Felix Sater to his friend Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's lawyer, often referred to as Donald Trump's other son, and they grew up next door to each other in Brooklyn. So this is Sater to Michael Cohen. Michael, I arranged for Ivanka to sit in Putin's private chair at his desk and office in the Kremlin. I will get Putin on this program and we'll get Donald elected. We both know no one else knows how to pull this off without stupidity or greed getting in the way. I know how to play it and we will get this done. Buddy, our boy can become president of the USA and we can engineer it. So I'm not sure that they can claim responsibility, but Trump did get elected president of the United States, right?
Well, he certainly did, but then the issue is really the tough one of, you know, to what extent was it due to some kind of conspiracy or, you know, kind of careful coordination with the Trump team? I mean, Putin was free to kind of intervene in the U.S. up to a point on his own, and he did so. There's no question about that. With the D.C. hacking and some of the hacking that went on the state level. But the real issue there is to what extent, you know, Putin has created a mole here in Donald Trump. And I just don't see the evidence for that sort of tightly knit conspiracy, that collusion that goes on. There was clearly an effort to try to recruit people in the Trump team, and probably Sater was involved in this effort as well. But as yet, we don't have the kind of, you know, in the Watergate case, we had tapes. Here, there are no tapes. There's not going to be any tapes because all of this was during the campaign. It was prior to being in the Oval Office. And, you know, we don't have any inside evidence. I mean, these emails are kind of suggestive of ongoing relationships that people who had connections in Moscow were trying to cultivate. But again, I think it falls short of showing that the president himself was actually party to this. You know, certainly he had people like Michael Cohen were engaged in lots of kind of business activities over the years, and this is just one of them. It didn't come to pass. I mean, you know, if we had a case where Putin had financed the Trump Tower in Moscow, if we had a case where there was big Russian oligarchs investing heavily in Trump Towers during this period, you know, that would be different. But that's kind of, you know, missing from this formula.
Well, He is, of course, still, nevertheless, this is the kind of person that Donald Trump has dealings with. And Sada, of course, was involved in a clash at in a bar where he stabbed another man in the face with a stem of a martini glass.
Yeah.
He went to prison for a year for that. He pleaded guilty to racketeering as part of a $40 million pump-and-dump stock fraud orchestrated by the mafia, and he avoided jail time by becoming a federal witness. Ironically, Andrew Weissman, the prosecutor who negotiated that plea deal, has been hired by Robert Mueller, and then Attorney General for the Eastern District of New York, Loretta Lynch, later to become the U.S. Attorney General. She wrote a letter to Senator Orrin Hatch during a confirmation as the AG, saying that Sada provided, quote, information crucial to national security and the conviction of over 20 individuals, including those responsible for committing massive financial frauds and members of La Cosa Nostra. So if that's true, how come he's walking around free as a bird? Wouldn't he ever...
Well, I think Sada has some fairly influential friends, and you know, some of them are a little bit embarrassed about what they enabled here, including some leading Democrats. I mean, this is a complicated story. You know, there's two theories, basically, of the Russian connection with Donald Trump. One is the so-called Putin mole theory. You know, and that's been out there for a while with respect to things like the Steele memorandum and various allegations about, you know, this coordinated election rigging. You know, for me, that's unproven. I think the thing that is substantiated and doesn't really depend at all on classified intelligence or this kind of understanding what went on in these meetings is the notion that Trump is basically a business guy who's, you know, protege of Roy Cohen. I mean, he does business all over the world with lots of shady people with too few questions asked. And for me, that's, you know, Sada is one of those people. I mean, there are quite a few others. The New Yorker just published a piece about Trump's business partners in Georgia. Baku is another example. Also the Panama Ocean Club. I mean, almost every, the Toronto Tower, I've published a lot about Alex Snyder, who was Trump's business partner in Toronto, you know, with the a bunch of different unsavory ties. So, you know, there are no question that Donald Trump has been engaged in kind of turning a blind eye to some of the bad behavior of people like Felix Sada over the years. But the real question is whether any of that is indictable or impeachable. And so far, we don't have hard evidence that the Russians, to this day, we have no evidence that the Russians actually had an impact on the November election, other than by, you know, leaking the WikiLeaks stuff and whatever impact that may have had on American opinion. So that's where we are.
But still, there's a very puzzling persistence on Donald Trump's part to keep saying nice things about Putin. And even yesterday at the press conference where Trump met with the president of Finland, reporters asked, do you consider Russia a security threat? And Trump refused to answer that. And then another Finnish reporter said, if Finland was attacked, could we rely on the United States? And again, Trump basically dodged that question and didn't give any kind of a confidence-building response to the Finns, who, of course, had a major war against Russia in the 1930s. So,
yeah, of course. I mean, no, Trump cannot be counted on to say the right thing when it comes to, you know, defending our NATO allies. But still the point is that it's a very mixed track record if you're trying to say this guy's a Putin mole. I mean, he has encouraged NATO to increase defense spending to 2% of GDP on average. He has attacked Syria once. He's been, you know, criticizing some of Russia's key allies like, you know, Iran. He's been picking fights with, I mean, there's no question that the fellow is producing a kind of idiosyncratic policy. But a lot of his views on these subjects go way back to before Putin, to, you know, to the 1980s when he was first went to Moscow in July of 87 and came back and took out this full-page ad in the Boston Globe that, you know, denounced NATO and said we shouldn't spend so much money on the defense of the Persian Gulf and Japan. I mean, he's had these kind of idiosyncratic views of U.S. foreign policy. And so unless we are prepared to believe that he was, you know, implementing some kind of Soviet script all the way through, you know, this is hard to account for. I think that to give Donald Trump, and it's hard for me to do this, some benefit of the doubt here, I think he really does think that the U.S. has pursued a kind of simple-minded relationship with Russia and, you know, may have been partly responsible for, you know, some of the friction in the Ukraine and Georgia by, you know, NATO expanding all the way to the east. That's not a view that's unique to Donald Trump. You know, why he persists in saying, failing to stand up for, you know, countries like Finland is a mystery. But on a whole host of fronts, I mean, he's not making Putin pleased right now. So it's really hard to say that he's anybody's mole. What you can say is that he's acting like the opportunist, like the business guy is, you know, would do, that he has been, and dealing with lots of shady people. And, you know, whether or not that adds up to any kind of business strategy or foreign policy is kind of a big problem for the United States. He's had a terrible effect, I think, on the U.S. image abroad because he's backed away from a lot of American values. I can't believe that that is really something that Putin would want him to do. I mean, maybe it is. Maybe that's the strategy, or that maybe that's the contribution. If he is a Putin protege, maybe he's, you know, he's just trying to wreak havoc with America's closest allies.
Weaken America across the
board. And weaken America in the process. And if that was his assignment, I mean, he seems to be...
Doing a hell of a job. As George W. Bush.
Yeah, exactly.
About,
so
about
that's, that's the closest I can come to saying he's behaving like any kind of a mole.
Well, this, just in closing, though, let's talk about just briefly about what this SATA story that's in the New York Times and Washington Post amounts to. Does it mean that the best that Mueller has so far that we can speculate on is that he could maybe get Trump on money laundering and on a RICO statute because of his association with a known gangster, Felix Sater. That's not going to cut it with Trump's 35%. The only way you're ever going to get those people to accept that Donald Trump is guilty and should be removed from office and impeached, they got to really find a real smoking gun. Anything short of that, we're going to have a rebellion in this country.
Well, I don't want to be intimidated by them. I mean, Mueller has a pretty clear-cut set of standards. He can look at anything to do with the rigging of the election, and he can look at anything that is, discovered in the course of that investigation. And I think, you know, this kind of behavior by Sater, where, well, maybe it was an overture indirectly from the Russians to, you know, entice Trump to come around, who knows? That's something to investigate. You're right in the sense that we don't have kind of the big ticket smoking gun that we had with Nixon, say, when he was, you know, caught on tape saying things were directly impeachable. The best we can say right now is from the standpoint of, I mean, the worst we can say right now from the standpoint of Trump's legal exposure here is that he was involved with some people like Sater, who continued through at least 2013 and probably 2015 to be engaged in businesses that had, you know, lots of dubious aspects to them. So, you know, we know that he was helping to a leading Kazakhstani a kleptocrat who moved a lot of money to Switzerland, invest his money in the United States, including some Trump towers. You know, whether you could hold Trump responsible for that is the question. But there, you're right that there is no, sort of murder on Fifth Avenue in broad daylight that would get his 35% moved.
At least not yet. So I thank you for joining us, James Henry. Thanks for the update.
Great. You're quite welcome. Good.
And again, I've been speaking with James Henry. He's an economist, lawyer, and investigative journalist. He is a Global Justice Fellow at Yale University, a Senior Fellow at the Center for Sustainable Investment at Columbia University, and a lead researcher at the Tax Justice Network, and the author of The Blood Bankers. And he's a co-founder with David K. Johnson of the new investigative reporting news service, dcreport.org. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back assessing what response is likely to come from Japan after a North Korean missile crossed over its territory in a deliberate provocation. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sheila Smith, a Senior Fellow for Japan Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. She is the author of Intimate Rivals, Japanese Domestic Politics and a Rising China, and Japan's New Politics and the U.S.-Japan Alliance. Her current research focuses on how geostrategic change in Asia is shaping Japan's strategic choices. And in the fall of 2014, she began a project on Northeast Asian nationalisms and alliance management. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sheila Smith.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you. And I imagine the Japanese have to be pretty furious about the missile launch from Pyongyang. Actually, apparently it was quite close to the airport at Pyongyang that this missile was lobbed across the northern island of Hokkaido, crashed into the sea to the east, the Pacific to the east. What's your sense of is there anything that the Japanese can do except sort of huff and puff and feel angry?
So they have been doing quite a bit, actually, in response to the North Korean missile threat. I think it's important for your American listeners, especially on the West Coast, who know the geography of Asia much better than many of us over here in the East Coast. But we all know that the North Koreans have been lobbying missiles in and around Japanese territory now for some time. This is not the first time a North Korean missile has gone through Japanese sovereign airspace. But it is the context of today is much different than it was in the previous times in the past. North Korea has a much better capability of managing both the trajectory of its missiles and also the accuracy in targeting where and when they come down. The immediate context, as we all know, of course, is the back and forth between the Trump administration and Kim Jong-un about Kim Jong-un's threat to send four missiles towards Guam, right? And our Secretary of Defense, Jim Masters, Mattis. Yes, I know. Sorry about that.
I just got promoted.
Jim Mattis basically said that would be an act of war, and we would take steps to defend ourselves, and signaled to the North Koreans, right, that we would use our ballistic missile defenses that were sitting on Guam. I think the Japanese feel that they are a bit of a softer target in this way from the North Koreans. They don't have the capacity to strike the Koreans. Japan has a defensive-oriented military force. It is a sophisticated military, not to be sneezed at by any means. But the Japanese have, in the post-war period, decided that they do not want offensive capability. Rather, they have invested in a ballistic missile defense system that will help them deal with North Korean missile threats. So they are feeling a little bit like they, because of this increasing vulnerability and because of the politics of the back and forth between Washington and Pyongyang, that they may be an easier target of intimidation for the North Koreans than the United States.
So in 1998, there was a North Korean missile flew over Japan, and again in 2009 at the beginning of the Obama administration. Both of these, of course, were supposedly carrying satellites into orbit. But in this case, North Korea has not made any claim that this was in any way not related to a military. So as far as we know, it's a medium-range Hwasong-12 missile, a mobile missile that was launched from apparently Pyongyang Airport. So is this, I don't understand why the North Koreans would be provoking the Japanese. I know there's a history, historical animus there, but if Japan were to go nuclear, it could do so fairly quickly. And if that reorients its military, which is a substantial military, away from defensive to an offensive capability, wouldn't that be counterintuitive and counterproductive from the North Korean point of view?
So I think the larger geostrategic consequences of this kind of behavior are definitely important. Let me give you a little sort of very nearsighted context here for this one. The U.S. and ROK, as you know, have been engaged in exercises that Kim Jong-un has said that he would respond to. Typically, North Korean military provocations or belligerent acts come as the U.S. and ROK are conducting their annual exercises. One piece of the puzzle here, and again, we have to speculate a little bit about what North Korean ambitions are here because we don't actually know for sure. But the U.S. and Japan added to that simultaneously a readiness drill for Patriot 3 ballistic missile defense. And I think, A, this is evidence of just how closely now the U.S. and Korea and the U.S. and Japan are coordinating their response to this recent persistent North Korean missile launches, right? So that's one piece of the puzzle. Could this have been a direct response to what was going on the ground between U.S. and Japanese forces? Don't know. Possibility, right? The larger question that you're asking, though, is, you know, what happens next? And the short-term answer is the Japanese will invest a considerable amount of money this year or next year in expanding and strengthening their missile defenses. So right now, they have the Patriot 3 system, which defends around areas. So if you have shrapnel or something coming in, the PAT-3s can strike as they approach the land. It's the last possible chance to deflect a missile, right? They have an Aegis missile, which is on ships. They can hit missiles at the tip of their ballistic trajectory or even earlier, right after launch. What Japan doesn't have is a much more complex web that would be able to protect Japan from start to finish. And we talk about this for the South Koreans. This is the THAAD system, that the theater high altitude defense system that the U.S. and Korea are now deploying. The Japanese are likely to go with a similar system, but it's an Aegis-related technology, so a slightly different maker, different brand, but a similar system. So that's going to happen. That's without a doubt. The second piece, though, is that the Japanese are going to be discussing whether or not the time has come for them to invest in their own missile capability. And you've heard this from Mr. Abe's party. The current Minister of Defense is an advocate of this position. But the idea here is ballistic missile defenses may not deter the North Koreans, and that because Japan has had this defensive posture, this may lead the North Koreans to miscalculate Japan's intentions to defend themselves. So what they see, the acquisition of a conventional strike capability, not nuclear weapons, but conventional weapons, missile capability, as a way of deterring Pyongyang from miscalculating their intent to defend their country. Now, this is a conversation that is going to emerge this year. You will hear it in the U.S.-Japan alliance. It's not a done deal. It's not a decision made. But it is, I think, it has been instigated largely by the North Koreans' acceleration of these missile launches.
So this is probably the 80th odd missile that Kim has launched, Kim Jong-un, and since he took power in late 2011. And it feels a little bit like a kind of delinquent acting up to get attention. Is there any way that we can ignore him and therefore take away his power?
No, I think, so there's two things about Kim Jong-un, right? One is, as you said, he's launched 80-some missiles since he came back into office, right? He is also largely seen as being behind some of the use of force incidents between North Korea and South Korea in 2010, before he came into power. I think attitudes in both of our allies in the region, in Northeast Asia, have largely shifted on this question of tolerance for the provocative behavior of Kim Jong-un, even in South Korea. And as you know, we have a progressive leader now that's been elected as president of South Korea, Moon Jae-in, who believes in dialogue and engagement and in reaching out to the North to make the peninsula a more peaceful place. He has been thoroughly rejected in these efforts, and surprisingly so. I think if Kim Jong-un had a different set of ambitions, that would have been the opportunity for him to establish a connection with the South. So he hasn't. He has responded to Moon Jae-in's initiatives and overtures simply by using force and by continuing missile launches and other kinds of behavior. In the broader context, though, here we have a young leader, third generation. It's more probably right to think of him as a third generation dynastic. he's inherited his grandfather's dynasty. He's used violence at home and abroad in killing his family members, but also in getting rid of, I think now, at least five defense ministers and others, right, without any compulsion whatsoever. And again, this is not a regime. His father was not known as being a nice guy either. This is a very repressive regime. But Kim Jong-un himself seems to have less restraint on the use of violence. So I think we should take that seriously. And the technological, I don't want to call it a red line, let's just call it a threshold, but the threshold we're approaching here and the one he's clearly said he wants to cross is he wants an ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile that can reach the United States. And on that, of course, he wants to put nuclear warheads or other kinds of weapons of mass destruction, either chemical or biological weapons that North Korea has plenty of. So this is an ambition he's been very clear about. In July, he did two tests that technical experts think have taken him a little bit further along the way to getting the kind of capability that would allow him to strike the United States. If he can threaten the homeland United States, it will make our allies in Asia very worried about our decision-making. Again, this is the famous, will Washington, right, trade Los Angeles for Tokyo, right? So I think for our allies, this raises a real existential question about the alliances themselves, and I think that's part of what his calculus is. But I think we ought to remember that China and Russia today stand a little bit more firmly on the side of the United States and Seoul and Tokyo in saying enough is enough. We shouldn't allow this country and this leader to cross that threshold. Nobody wants a nuclear North Korea, especially under this volatile leader. And so today there's a Security Council meeting. I'm going to be very interested in seeing what comes out of that meeting. I think in Beijing and Moscow also, they must be very worried about just exactly where Kim Jong-un is headed here.
But in terms of Kim Jong-un's killing sprees, the most conspicuous was the murder of his, or the assassination of his older half-brother at the airport in Malaysia, using sarin gas and a binary version of sarin gas, which mm-hmm. is fairly advanced. But it was hardly... It had to be interpreted as a signal. In other words, you don't just kill somebody. You don't use such a provocative means to kill somebody. So that seemed to be one, sending a message. And two, isn't there a possibility that he was eliminating his older half brother because he didn't want the Chinese to have this possible, Kim in waiting for any kind of Chinese engineered coup? Who is he most paranoid about? Is he paranoid about the possibility of somebody within the regime trying to topple him, or the Chinese, who I think appear to be increasingly frustrated by him?
So again, it's hard to get into the mindset of Kim Jong-un, but I think we saw with that, as you said, with that very conspicuous assassination, right, of Kim Jong-un, whose family has been under protection of the Chinese, right? That was a sign that clearly he was quite willing to cross into the public domain and make sure that he didn't have somebody that the Chinese could pro-offer to the Korean elites as the other Kim, right? The other successor with the lineage of his own lineage to his grandfather and father. I think the son of Kim Jong-nam is the other question. There's been a video that circulated. Again, I am not a North Korea watcher, so this is expertise that I have gained from others. But there is a next generation that is in the wings. I don't know how much China would be willing to replace. This is in the realm of the spy novel, right? Would China really be willing to overturn, would there be enough people in Pyongyang willing to take on that task of overthrowing Kim Jong-un? Hard to tell. I think until we get to a point where there's evidence that that's underway, we really don't know. I do think, however, that it's important that we remember he's in his 30s. He is liable to be around for a very long time. He wants the nuclear arsenal and his missile arsenal. He wants the respect, and I think most of our experts believe he wants to be a recognized nuclear power. If that's the case, then we have a few hard choices here ahead of us, and by we, I mean the international community as well as the U.S. and its allies. Can we prevent him from reaching that outcome? And I think for most of us, even for our Chinese colleagues, government and the Russian government, they are not willing to accept Kim as a nuclear power, Kim to be in control of a nuclear arsenal. So you have an international community here that is not willing to accept what he himself says he is bound and determined to achieve. So you have a bit of a standoff here, and that's where this kind of escalating use of military capabilities is dangerous. I have a lot of people who are advocating for dialogue. I think there are feelers out from the Trump administration, from Beijing, from others, trying to figure out a way to get this, at least the tensions reduced, but also to think about crafting what would we put on the table to negotiate when we got there. And frankly, the United States and its allies will accept nothing less than denuclearization, pure and simple, verifiable denuclearization, which means the opening up of that regime's nuclear arsenal and weapons arsenals. And Kim Jong-un has given no indication he's willing to come to the table. So we have a bit of a diplomatic standoff in which I suspect we are going to continue to see financial and economic sanctions as mandated by the more recent UN Security Council resolution. I'll be very interested to see what comes out of the conversation today and tomorrow. That missile test is in complete violation of the UN Security Council resolutions, and so it does suggest that another layer of collective action may be necessary. And so that becomes a tricky test here of just when and if we can get a coalition response to his belligerence. At some point, I expect that there will be a moment of reckoning for the ballistic missile defense systems of the United States and its allies if he continues to threaten with missile launches the way he did this morning.
Meaning that we're going to try and shoot down one of his missiles?
I think so. Yeah. I think that's the next step, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, but just in closing then, given that the Chinese are, and the Russians are on board, although Russia is encouraging tourism into North Korea at the moment, nevertheless, are there elements within China, perhaps in the PLA, that like the idea of Kim having a nuclear weapons arsenal, albeit a small one, that threatens U.S. power in the Pacific and Guam, etc.? It gives them a little. They have stable strategic deterrence with the United States, much fewer weapons than we have. But on the other hand, when you've got this wild card out there, that's basically on your side, or at least against your enemy, then you've got an extra hedge. It's rather like what the Iranian regime has with Hezbollah in Lebanon.
I think the difference of the equation out in Northeast Asia, though, Ian, is that you also have Japan and South Korea in the mix here. The Japanese are getting increasingly uncomfortable with the vulnerability that they're experiencing, right? And again, when we talked about conventional strike, the conventional strike debate, I think that's evidence of that discomfort. That doesn't mean that Japan is about to go willy-nilly in the direction of massive acquisition of military power. But I do think for the Chinese, looking at that, what they're seeing is the U.S. allies in the region, both of whom are non-nuclear powers, right? South Korea and Japan, are getting increasingly entwined and integrated into an American defense network that doesn't make the Chinese comfortable. The Chinese have been vociferously antagonistic towards the South Koreans on their decision to introduce THAAD, the Theater High Altitude Defense Missile Defense System, going so far as to boycott goods from South Korean companies and cutting off tourism and really using a coercive economic response to the South Korean decision on THAAD. And that was during the election that led up to Moon Jae-in's arrival in the presidency there. Moon himself has been hesitant about that. He doesn't want China to be discomfited by South Korean cooperation with the United States. But on the other hand, the North Korean missile launches have made him even more convinced that that was a good decision. So he's gotten a little bit more on board on that decision. Japan's enhancing of its missile defenses is equally going to improve its own capabilities in terms of surveillance, and it's going to deepen the Japanese ability to look beyond their national borders at what's happening across the Asian region. So remember, missile defenses are to detect and to track and then to intercept missiles. So they enhance the surveillance and intelligence gathering capabilities of the countries that have them. That is not comfortable and will not be comfortable for the Chinese. So China and Russia have both come out in opposition to THAAD and to any further development of missile defenses in Northeast Asia. So the military balance in the region is being shifted by the North Koreans' expansion and use of these new missile capabilities. They cannot be in Beijing. They cannot feel comfortable about this. Moscow, of course, and Beijing both have economic ties with Pyongyang. Beijing, of course, the most, about 90%, I think, of the revenue that North Korea gets from trade with the outside world comes from either the purchase of materials from North Korea by China or the sales of Chinese goods to North Korea. China is the key here in terms of leverage. But both Moscow and Beijing have an avenue into the Kim regime that we just don't. So if there is a mediating role to be played diplomatically, then Moscow and Beijing have the responsibility, I believe, to stand up here now if they believe what they have firmly said they believe in the United Nations and try to figure out how to get Kim Jong-un to the table. I think we're going to see whatever happens in the way that this unfolds. It will deeply influence the trajectory of the military balance in Northeast Asia, and in doing so, it will put American interests as well right there in the crosshairs. I hope we have a pathway forward for a peaceful resolution of this, but right now we have, I think, a rogue state with a military capability it is quite willing to use to influence the security of its neighbors, and that will not be tolerable for much longer, I think, by those neighbors.
Well, Sheila Smith, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Sheila Smith, who's a senior fellow for Japan Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's the author of Intimate Rivals, Japanese Domestic Politics and a Rising China, and Japan's New Politics and the U.S.-Japan Alliance. Her current research focuses on how geostrategic change in Asia is shaping Japan's strategic choices. And in the fall of 2014, she began a project on Northeast Asian nationalisms and alliance management. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.